ground floor of the chateau. Philip and Elise were subdued and confused and a little too scared to be angry. From there, he was shuffled up to the third floor to a large room that was set up similar to the conference room at the Laurent Group subsidiary in London. There was a seat for him, a big Louis XV armchair. Lloyd had his own chair, a sleek black modern model. The tech was already on station, setting up equipment on a long bank of tables that had been hauled in from other rooms and pushed together to suit his needs. He was just now flipping switches on laptops and radio sets, bringing the new operations center online. The room had three doors leading from it. One was to an adjoining bathroom, the second was to the main hall, and the third, Fitzroy noted when one of the Belarusian guard force came through it to speak privately with Lloyd, was the entrance to a small spiral staircase that surely went both up towards the tower above them and continued down to the lower floors. The new arrivals from London were still just settling in when Sir Donald's phone vibrated on the table next to his chair. A wire ran from it to a speaker box on the table. As Lloyd pushed the button to answer, the tech shouted to the room that he was not yet ready to trace the call.
"Cheltenham Security," said Sir Donald.
His voice was tiring, scratched.
"It's me," said the gray man.
"How are you, lad?"
There was a long pause. Finally,
"You told them about Guarda."
Fitzroy did not deny it. He said softly, wearily,
"Yes, I did. I am truly sorry."
"Not as sorry as you're gonna be when your family dies. Goodbye and good luck, Don."
Lloyd stood in the middle of the room. Quickly, he walked to the table, leaned over the phone, and spoke.
"Good morning, Cortland."
There was no reply on the line for so long that Lloyd picked up the little phone and looked at it to see if the call was still open.
"Who the hell is this?"
"Cort, you may not want to be so hard on the good knight here. I'm afraid I put him in an utterly untenable position."
"Who are you?"
"You don't recognize my voice?"
"No."
"We used to work together. It's Lloyd."
There was nothing. Lloyd continued.
"From Langley. Back in the Halcyon days, you know."
"Lloyd?"
"That's right. How have you been?"
"I don't remember a Lloyd."
"Come now, Mr. Gentry. It hasn't been that long. I worked for Hanley, helped run you and some of the other assets on the sharp end back in the Goon Squad days."
"I remember Hanley. Don't remember you."
Fitzroy could see that Lloyd was genuinely offended.
"Well, you knuckle-draggers and door-kickers were never known for your social IQ."
He looked over at Sir Donald, embarrassed, perhaps. He waved a dismissive hand.
"Doesn't matter. What does matter is, even though you may feel disinclined to come here to Normandy to help your fearless leader, you might consider keeping your current travel itinerary for now. Because, let me assure you, there is still something here you do want."
"There's nothing I want bad enough to knowingly walk into a trap. Goodbye, Floyd."
"It's Lloyd, no F, double L, and you might want to stay on the line to hear my sales pitch."
"Were you the one who put out the burn notice on me 4 years ago?"
asked Gentry. His voice was measured and sounded dispassionate over the phone, but Fitzroy knew a question like that must come filled with emotion and intensity.
"No, I didn't burn you. At the time, I disagreed with the decision. I thought you still could have been useful to us."
"So who burned me? Hanley?"
"That's a discussion for another day. Maybe we'll talk it over when you get here."
"It's a date. Bye."
"At the moment, you should be less worried about who burned you in 06, and more worried about who will burn you tomorrow if you don't drop in for a visit."
Gentry snorted into the phone.
"Can't be burned twice."
"Sure you can. When I left the agency, I took out a little insurance policy. I saw what happened to you and a few other men. I knew what barbarity the politicians who run the company were capable of when a heretofore successful operation falls out of favor with the men and women who have to testify before Congress. I told myself, Lloyd, you're too smart to go down like dumb old Court Gentry and the others. So, I did what I had to do to ensure my survival. You stole secrets. Like I said, I'm a survivor.
You're a traitor.
Same thing. I copied documents detailing operations, sources and methods, personnel files.
Personnel files?
Yes. I have them with me right now.
Bullshit.
Just a moment. Fitzroy watched Lloyd thumb through some papers in a gold folder on the table. There was a stack of similar folders alongside the one the young American picked up. Gentry, Cortland, A., born 4-18-74 in Jacksonville, Florida. Parents, Jim and Lila Gentry. One brother, deceased, entered grammar school in...
That's enough.
I've got more. I've got it all. Your agency history with the Special Activities Division and the Autonomous Asset Development Program. Your Golf Sierra exploits. Your known associates. Photos, fingerprints, dental records, etc., etc.
What do you want?
I want you to come to Normandy.
Why?
That will be discussed when you arrive. The pause lasted long enough for Fitzroy to hear snippets from the second floor of the chateau below him. Elise was yelling at Philip. Sir Donald knew the marriage was rocky, knew this pressure was the last thing they needed. Finally, Gentry spoke.
Do what you have to do, Lloyd. Put my documents out there. I don't give a shit. I'm done with this.
Very well. I'll spray your data to the world. Within a week, every mobster you've wronged, every enemy agency you've run against, every grumpy assassin you've beat out for a contract, they all will be after you. It will make the last 48 hours look like a vacation in a day spa.
I can handle it.
And Fitzroy dies. His family dies. Can you handle that?
A slight hesitation. He shouldn't have screwed me.
Okay. You are a hard man, Cord. I get it. But there is just one other thing I forgot to mention. Yours were not the only personnel files I filched from the agency. If you do not come to Normandy, I will distribute the names, photographs, and known associates files of all the operators in the Special Activities Division, active, inactive, retired, or otherwise indisposed. Every company trigger man will become just like you. Burned, hunted, left hung out to dry because their services have been rendered useless and their names are popping up on every search engine on the internet. It was a long time before Gentry spoke.
What the fuck is this all about? Why would you do that just to get to me?
This isn't about you, you arrogant shit! You are insignificant in the scope of the real objective, but I need you here. I need you here, or I will scorch the earth clean of America's best covert operators. I'll see that every SAD asset and all their known associates are hunted dogs.
Court Gentry said nothing. Fitzroy cocked his head, thought he could hear the clacking cadence of a train over tracks in the background of the connection. Lloyd next said,
Of course, it will take a few days to dump all the personnel files of you and the SAD boys onto the net. There's so damn much of it. I'll have to start with something else. If you're not here bright and early tomorrow morning, the first to check out will be the Fitzroy family downstairs. I figure I'll begin with the little ones. The first in, first out principle. You know what I mean? I'll kill the babies. Kill the parents, and then top off my morning by killing old man Fitzroy here.
Gentry spoke up finally.
If you touch Claire or Kate, I will find you, and I will torture you so slowly that the only prayer on your lips will be for a quick death.
Lloyd clapped his hands.
That's what I like to hear! Emotion! Passion! Well... You'd better get here in time for eggs and biscuits tomorrow, because snapping the necks of those pretty little girls will be the first order of business after breakfast.
Fitzroy had been silent, sullen. He'd sat to the side during the conversation like a forgotten dog, but when Lloyd spoke this last piece, Sir Donald launched from his Louis XV chair and onto the American and grabbed at the young man's throat.
freshly led wires to the computers and speakers became caught up in their legs, and equipment was ripped from the table. Lloyd's swivel chair flipped up as the two crashed to the ground. Sir Donald tore off Lloyd's wire-rimmed glasses and smashed his fists into the taut cheekbones of his adversary's face. It took almost 10 seconds for the two Northern Irish guards to enter the room and pull the heavy Englishman off the young American solicitor. When finally they were separated, Fitzroy was shoved back in his chair. The two Scottish guards next rushed in and held his head and his arms. Shouts and screaming echoed all over the third floor as one of the Belarusians came up with chains found in the garage alongside the greenhouse. Fitzroy was strapped roughly into his chair, but he still fought against them all as chains were run over the arms and legs of the Louis XV and tightly around the arms and legs of Sir Donald. The cold steel links were strung around his neck, another loop at his forehead. Everything was secured with a huge padlock. All the while, Lloyd remained on the floor. He'd sat up, breathing heavily, pushed his hair back in place, and retightened his necktie. He found his glasses on the floor, bent the arms a bit to approximate their original shape, and put them back on. His face was scratched slightly. His arms and chin and neck were bruised, but he was otherwise uninjured. Finally, he climbed back into his chair and rolled back up to the desk near the telephone.
"Sorry, Court. Some technical difficulties there. We're back with you. You still there?"
But Gentry had hung up. Lloyd looked to Fitzroy. Fitzroy looked to Lloyd, basically because he could look nowhere else with his head immobilized with chains.
"He'd better stay on track, Don. He'd better stay on track, or you and your family are going to die slow and miserable fucking deaths. You take me for some Ivy League lightweight? So did the CIA. I was shuffling policy papers while the door kickers got all the glory. Well, fuck them and fuck you. I can play as dirty as the best of the dirty tricks, boys. I can and I will do what I need to do to see this through. Ebu Bakr will sign the contract and we'll be readying our natural gas operation by noon tomorrow. You and yours will be forgotten by me. Between now and then, you can live or you can die. I could not give a rat's ass which. It's your decision, Donnie boy. Pull that shit again and see if I give you a third chance."
"Court will stay on track. He will come. And he will kill you."
"He won't make it here. But even if he does, the gray man who makes it here will be a very different man than the one you know. He'll be hurt, short on time, short on sleep, short on gear."
"Gear?"
"Yes. These types are lost without their gear."
Sir Donald chuckled angrily.
"You haven't a clue what you're talking about. Court's most valuable piece of kit is between his ears. The only weapon he needs is his mind. Everything else, guns, knives, bombs, they're all just accessories."
"Ridiculous. You've bought into the fairy tale of tactical operators. A glorified goon is all he is."
"It's no fairy tale, and there is no glory in what he does. He's a man at work, and as cold and as brutal and as efficient as a corner butcher going about his business. Get in his way and you'll see."
"Oh, I have every intention of getting in his way."
Fitzroy's corpulent face was beet red and covered in sweat after struggling with five men. He was chained like a beast to the chair with the thick links covering a third of his head. Still, he smiled.
"I've dealt with talkers before, little wankers who move their mouths when their backs are to the wall, pricks with power. I have seen many a chap like you come and go in my day. You will have your moment, and then your moment will pass. You don't scare me."
Lloyd's face twitched as he leaned close to Fitzroy.
"No? How about I walk downstairs, say eeny, meeny, miny, moe, come back up here with a little pigtailed prize? How about I..."
"You little sot! Scared of the man in chains, so you threaten a child. The more you try to show me how dangerous you are, the more you fit into the mold of exactly what I took you for the first time I saw you. A weak little Nancy boy, a pathetic prat. You can't sort out an old man lashed to a chair, so you have to go after a weaker target. Bloody fucking wanker.
Lloyd's eyes narrowed with fury, and his breath was heavy in Fitzroy's face. Slowly, the American sat up, smiled a little. He lifted a strand of hair away from where it had dropped on his forehead, pressed it back along his scratched scalp.
I'll show you what I can do to you. Just you and me.
He reached a hand out behind him, back to one of the security men from Minsk by the door.
Somebody give me a goddamned knife.
Chapter 19. Song Park Kim awoke at dawn in his suite at the swank Plaza Atenei. His quarters surrounded him with opulence, but he did not sleep on the bed, did not drink from the minibar, did not partake of the room service. He'd slept in a back closet on the floor after rigging tripwires and telltales all around him. He left his room at 6 a.m. and began walking through the streets of Paris, memorizing the roads that led from the right bank, over bridges, to the left bank, taking in the looks and mannerisms of the Westerners, and memorizing the natural choke points of both automobile and pedestrian traffic. He'd received a list of names and addresses on his GPS, the gray man's known associates in Paris, a former CIA co-worker who now headed a market intelligence firm in a skyscraper in La Défense, to the west of the city, an Afghani interpreter used by the Special Activities Division in Kabul in 2001, who now ran a swank Middle Eastern restaurant in the left bank on the Boulevard Saint-Germain, an informant in Fitzroy's network who was also a federal pen pusher at the Ministry of the Interior in an office near the Place de la Concorde, a pilot of renowned skill who had flown for the SAD in Europe and now lived semi-retired in the Latin Quarter. The Korean used public transportation to take a quick look at each site, checking them all out. Access to the buildings, locations of nearby parking, and public transportation routes to and from each area. He knew there were local watchers hired by the people who had hired his government to send him, and in fact, he'd seen men and women at every site on his list, men and women unable to remain undetected by an exceedingly well-trained operator. He had no doubt the gray man would see them too. Kim knew he would have to supplant their support with his own tracking skills. Afterwards, Kim patrolled the city center, still studying the map. He was prepared to rush back to any of the known associates' locations if there was a gray man sighting, but he did not expect his adversary to use an associate on his current mission. If he could, Kim was certain, the gray man would bypass Paris altogether. It was too congested an area, with too many police and too many cameras and too many old acquaintances that would invariably be under surveillance. If the American assassin was forced to go into the city for some reason, Kim knew, he'd do his utmost to get what he needed from sources other than those who could be traced back to him. Kim knew this because he himself was a lone assassin, a singleton. He himself had been hunted down like a dog, and he himself had been forced to avoid all those who might have been inclined to help him. But Kim also knew that isolation, exhaustion, injury, necessity, and desperation all led to mistakes, and he knew that if his target somehow made it as far as Paris and had some need in the city, the gray man would be a desperate animal indeed, and all bets were off as to how he would act and react. This operator was perhaps already the most dangerous man in the world. Throwing in wild-eyed fear and a frantic race against time might make him slip up. But it would also make him even more dangerous to those around him. Kim knew that if the call came that the gray man was here, then blood would flow like a river through the streets of the City of Lights. Gentry had ridden his stolen bike through the snowy dawn, then pulled up to the train station at the village of Ardez. A few locals milled about, waiting for the first morning trains west to Zurich or east to the Italian or Austrian borders. The American borrowed a cell phone from a kid waiting for the eastbound train and paid the teenage boy the equivalent of $40 to call Fitzroy for 5 minutes to confront his handler about selling him out.
He walked 20 yards down the cement platform for privacy and stood in the snow as a train to Interlaken rolled by. He'd finally hung up the phone when a fight broke out on the other end of the line, erased the number in the phone's memory, and handed it back to the kid with the cash. A few minutes later, Cort climbed aboard the first train of the morning to Zurich. It was a Saturday, so he was the only passenger in his car for the majority of the hour and 45-minute travel time through the narrow valley. One after another, the bright red train chugged on past the railroad stations of the villages along its tracks. Gentry warmed up on the train, checked his wounds by dropping his pants in the empty car and poking at the sores on his knees and at the entrance and exit wounds on his stinging thigh with his fingertips. He was afraid he might have contracted an infection in the gunshot wound. Certainly, swimming in Sabot's cistern hadn't helped. Otherwise, he was okay. He'd put miles on the lacerations on his feet, and they did little more than throb, just like his broken rib. He knew he had to continue on to Normandy, though he felt his odds for success were lessening with each mile nearer he came to the trap waiting for him. Fitzroy was a bastard for tricking him as he had, but, Cort had to admit, Lloyd had put Sir Donald into one hell of a difficult position. Cort wondered what lengths he himself would have gone to, who he would have sold out, if the twins were his family and their lives were jeopardized by some motherfucker with a mob of gun monkeys and no compunction about killing innocent children. Thinking about Lloyd made Gentry's blood boil. He honestly didn't remember the guy, but the CIA had never gone wanting for lightweight, desk-riding a-holes who worked way back in the rear of covert operations, while the gray man and those like him operated on the sharp edge. Cort couldn't picture any faces, but once in a while his superiors had cause to introduce him to some Langley suit. Lloyd must have been one of these, before taking top-secret SAD personnel records and leaving the company for the private sector. What a prick. Cort wanted to recall Lloyd, find something back in his memory banks that could somehow help him out of his current predicament. But the rhythm of the train along the tracks began to carry him off to sleep. With all his cuts, bruises, pulled muscles, and extra holes, it was a chore to relax at all, but it was almost as if he was too tired to hurt. He fell asleep a few minutes before arriving in Zurich, was jarred awake by the slowing of the train and the recorded announcement of the impending stop. As he stood and made his way to the exit, he cussed himself for his lack of discipline, for dozing with hunters so close on his tail. In the Zurich Hauptbahnhof, he bought a ticket for Geneva. It would mean another 2 hours on the rails, so he made his way over to a sausage counter and bought a large bratwurst and a cup of coffee. It was a grotesque combination, but he hoped the jolt of caffeine and the half-pound of solid protein would keep his body alert. With 20 minutes until his train's departure, he descended the escalator to a large shopping center 2 levels below the station, found a pay bathroom, and commandeered a stall. Here he sat, fully dressed on the porcelain, leaned his head back on the cold wall behind him. He drew his pistol and held it at the ready in his lap. Train stations were obvious places for his enemies to hunt him. He didn't like the scarcity of escape routes in a bathroom stall, but still, he knew he was better off hiding in the toilet than he would be standing at his track for a quarter hour just begging to be identified by the opposing force. If Lloyd's goons found him here, then he'd just empty a couple of magazines into the door of the stall in front of him and try to bust his way out. It wasn't a good plan, but Cort admitted to himself, by taking on this operation in the first place, he had foregone any pretense of wisdom. Now, it was just about making his way through the shit in the hopes he would live to, and maybe even through, 8 o'clock on Sunday morning. With less than a minute to departure, Gentry walked up the platform alongside Track 17 and slipped silently on the train to Geneva, just as it began to roll. Regal's phone rang at 9:40 in the morning. He was in his office, putting in a full day on Saturday, having reluctantly canceled a weekend grouse-hunting trip in Scotland.
Regal?
Sir, Krilgau speaking.
Kruger was a Swiss security chief for Laurent Group based in Zurich.
I have information on the target. I had been instructed to contact Mr. Lloyd, but I thought I would let you know.
Fine, Kruger. I'll pass the information. What do you have?
I have him, sir. He's just boarded the 940 for Geneva. Second-class ticket. No seat reservation.
Geneva? Why is he going south? He should be headed west.
He could be running away.
Giving up, I mean.
Maybe. Maybe not. It's out of his way, but he does have associations there.
I can have surveillance in Geneva ready to intercept him at the station.
No. We'll arrange a different welcoming party for him there if that is his actual destination. This could be a misdirection. He might get off along the way, take another train to France. I need you to organize coverage at every station where that train stops between Zurich and Geneva. Also, make sure he doesn't get off before the train leaves.
I'm on the train myself now. I'll babysit him along the route and update you as we get closer.
Alles klar. Good work.
Riegel next called the tech at the chateau in Normandy.
Get the Venezuelans heading south to catch up with the 940 from Zurich to Geneva. The gray man is on board, but he may try to get off along the way. The Venezuelans need to be ready to take him down at a moment's notice.
Understood.
Riegel consulted a large map of Switzerland on his desk.
Get the South Africans in Basel to Geneva. If Gentry makes it alive to the station, they'll need to follow him out and do him in the street. There will be too many cameras and cops in the station.
Court didn't last 15 minutes. He'd found a window seat on the top level at the back of the last car in second class. He'd taken off his coat and draped it over his body. Under it, he pulled his pistol and laid it in his lap with his hand on the grip. And then he drifted off to sleep.
Weiss.
He woke slowly, his head leaning against the window. Though his vision was blurred by his bloodshot eyes, he watched snow flurries beating the window next to his face. He wanted to stick his tongue out and taste a fat flake through the glass. The countryside was covered in white. Only the sheerest stony mountains shone gray and brown, where the snowfall found the grade too steep for a foothold. The sky hung low and gray, and a village streaked by before him. It was a beautiful winter morning.
Ausweis!
A voice said, close on his right. Court turned and looked quickly. He recognized the authority to the command. Four uniformed Swiss police officers stood in the aisle above him. They wore gray pants and two-tone gray jackets. They were municipal, city cops, not the highly trained feds. Big Glock 17s hung off their hips, an outstretched hand at the end of the outstretched arm of the oldest cop.
Ausweis, bitte!
Court understood travel German. The white-haired police sergeant wanted to see some ID, not a train ticket. Not good. Gentry moved the gun hidden under his coat, crammed it between the plastic cushion and the wall of the train car as he sat up. Gentry had no identification, only a ticket. Once the weapon was out of view, he fished through his coat, pulled out the ticket, and handed it over. The cop didn't even look at it. Instead, he switched to English.
Identification, please.
I lost my passport. I'm heading to the embassy in Geneva to get another.
All four policemen obviously understood English, because all four policemen looked at Court like he was full of shit.
You are American?
Asked the older officer.
Canadian.
Court knew he was in trouble. He may have dumped the pistol, but there was a leather holster velcroed around his ankle. These guys looked sharp enough. There was no chance they would not frisk him. When they found the empty rig on his leg, the cops would just check his seat and find his gun.
Where's your luggage?
Stolen, I told you.
There was no sense in making friends. Court knew he'd probably have to kick these guys' asses before it was all over. He didn't feel great about knocking a bunch of innocent policemen's heads together, but he saw no way around it. Although it would be a four-on-one fight, the American operator knew that with surprise, speed, and violence of action, he could get the upper hand in such a small space like a train aisle. He'd done it before. Just then, the door to the car opened, and three more policemen filed in. They stayed at the door, far back from the rest of the scrum. Shit. 7-on-1. They were taking no chances. Gentry had no illusions about disabling 4 men, then advancing 25 feet and taking down 3 more, before being riddled with gunfire.
"Please stand," said the silver-haired policeman in front of him.
"Why? What did I do?"
"Please stand and I will explain."
"I'm just heading to...
I will not ask you again."
Court dropped his shoulders, stood, and took one step into the aisle. A young cop approached and spun him around. Quickly, his hands were cuffed behind his back. The other passengers in the car watched with fascination. Camera phones appeared, and Gentry did his best to turn away from them. He was frisked by the young officer, who almost immediately discovered the folding knife in his pocket and the ankle holster on his leg. His seat was searched, and the pistol lifted high into the air like a trophy for all the car to see. "I am a United States federal agent." Court said this because he didn't really have much else. He did not expect them to just hand him back his gun and pat him on the ass, but he hoped they might relax a little and give him some opportunity to escape.
"This no identification?"
asked the officer in charge.
"I lost it."
"So you said. Have you been this morning in Guarda?"
asked one of the cops. The gray man, who, surrounded by camera phones and wide-eyed stares, did not feel much like a gray man, did not answer. One of the new policemen back at the entrance spoke into his walkie-talkie. A moment later, the train began to slow. Chapter 20 Regal took the call at 11:38 in the morning.
"Sir, Kruger again. Gentry has been taken off the train at a little village called Marnand. Not a scheduled stop."
"Taken off by who?"
"Municipal. He is cuffed and just sitting on the platform surrounded by the police. I heard one of the cops calling for a transport wagon to be sent up from Lausanne."
"It should take no more than 30 minutes.
"Did you get off the train as well?"
"No other passengers were allowed off. I'll disembark in Lausanne and go directly to the police station. Wait for him to arrive."
Regal stared at a map on his computer as he hung up and called Lloyd.
"Tell the Venezuelans Gentry's in Marnand, about 30 kilometers north of Lausanne. The police have him."
The American answered back immediately.
"They can't have him. We need him."
Regal looked across his desk. The heads of a dozen brilliant animals, trophies of his hunts, stared back at him. He said,
"I know that. Tell the Venezuelans they are weapons-free. They can destroy whoever gets in their way."
"Now we're talking. Are they any good?"
"They are from the General Intelligence Office, Hugo Chavez's secret police. They are the best Caracas has to offer."
"Right. Are they any good?"
"We'll know soon enough, won't we?"
Gentry sat shivering on a wooden bench on the one platform of the small train station. His left hand had been cuffed to the bench's iron armrest. 5 municipal cops stood around him in the light snowfall. The rest had stayed on the train. He'd gotten the idea that his description had been distributed after the morning ruckus in Guarda. He guessed the stolen bike showing up at the train station in Ardez earned the ticket girl a questioning by the police. She would have remembered a foreigner on the first train to Zurich that morning. Zurich being the main transportation hub in the tiny nation, it was just a matter of alerting every cop to check every train, bus, and aircraft out of Zurich for a brown-haired male in his 30s traveling alone. The sign on the platform said Marnand. He had no idea where this burg was on the map, but his body felt like he may have gotten a couple of hours of sleep, so he suspected he was not far from Geneva. He had to find a way to get free from these guys and get back on the road. In the back of his head, a clock was ticking. The lead policeman sat down next to him. His hair was white like a snow-capped mountain peak, and he smelled of fresh aftershave.
"We wait for a car from Lausanne. They take you to the station. Detectives come and talk to you about the fight in Guarda and the gun you have on train."
"Yes, sir."
Gentry was trying on the friendly approach now, his strategy blowing around like a summer wind, because he did not know what else to do. It wouldn't win him release, but it easily could help him get the upper hand with the police, cause them to lower their guard just enough for him to find a window of opportunity to exploit. Still, carrying a gun in your pants in Switzerland was an outrage with nearly the gravitas of mass murder in America.
Can I go to the bathroom?
No. Hold your piss.
The younger cops around laughed. Court sighed. It was worth a shot. Off to his left, down the platform, a two-lane road twisted up and over a rise. The road was wet and clean and black like licorice, bisecting the white snowfall on the hill. A dark green panel truck was parked high up on the hill, 50 yards from the station's edge, and 100 yards or so from where Court sat and his police guards stood on the station's single platform. Exhaust vapors blew out from the muffler, rose into the air behind the vehicle. Court looked to his right now, still trying to find a way to gain the advantage before more cops showed up. To his right was the edge of the village proper. Gingerbread homes were sprinkled in among more modern structures. Plumes of wood smoke floated into the air above the homes and dissipated in the gray sky above. A green truck, identical to the one on his right, rolled slowly out of the village and pulled into a gas station 30 yards from where Court sat. It jolted to a stop in the parking lot, away from the pumps. The gray man decided in seconds that he had just been surrounded.
"Sergeant!"
he called quickly to the cop in charge. The older man was speaking with his subordinates, but he walked over towards Court on the bench.
"Please listen carefully. We have a problem. On both sides of us are green trucks. In or near those vehicles are men who have been sent to kill me. They will not hesitate to kill you and your men to get to me."
The policeman looked to his left and right at both of the vehicles, then back to Gentry.
"What is this shit you are saying?"
"They will be well-trained killers. You need to move us all inside the station. Hurry!"
Slowly, the policeman pulled his walkie-talkie from his belt and brought it to his mouth. His eyes did not leave Gentry's. In German, he instructed his men behind him to come over. He switched to English.
"Two green vehicles. One to the north, one to the south. This man tells me they are men here to rescue him."
"Not rescue, kill!"
All five looked up and down the platform at the vans. There was still no movement from either.
"It's a trick,"
said a young blonde officer as he unfastened the retention restraint over the tang of his pistol.
"Who are you?"
asked another man. Court didn't answer. Instead, he said,
"We need to go inside, quickly."
The lead policeman told his officers,
"Watch him. I'll check this out."
He turned and began walking up the platform towards the van to the south at the gas station.
"Sergeant, you really do not want to do that,"
Court called out, but was ignored by the silver-headed policeman in the heavy coat. The cop descended the platform steps and onto the property of the little gas station. The green van had tinted windows. It sat at idle, steam pouring from its exhaust and drifting away in the air behind. As the municipal officer approached the truck, Gentry spoke to the four remaining men.
"He's going to die. Don't freak out. We will all have to work together. If you try to run, they will just gun you down. If you want to live, just do what I say."
"Shut up,"
said one, and all four were looking at their sergeant as he approached the driver's side window. He used his walkie-talkie to tap on the tinted glass.
"Don't forget about the other van,"
Court pleaded to the uniformed man standing over him.
"Shut up,"
repeated the policeman. Gentry could see their growing concern as their heads swiveled back and forth between the north and south. The sergeant tapped harder on the glass. As Gentry and the others watched, the silver-haired man seemed to peer closely through the heavy tint. He must have seen something, some movement or other indicator of danger, because quickly the Swiss policeman stepped back and reached down to the pistol on his hip. The driver's side window shattered with a crack of gunfire. The cop backpedaled away quickly and the door opened. A man in a black jumpsuit and a ski mask slid out from behind the wheel and onto the pavement, a short-barreled machine pistol in his hand. He fired another 3-round burst into the sergeant's stumbling body, and the Swiss officer dropped dead on his back. All four Swiss cops around Court drew their pistols, with technique hampered by panic. At 30 yards, an accurate shot would be difficult, but the young men fired rounds downrange as they shouted in shock and dropped for cover.
"The other truck! The other fucking truck!"
Court screamed as he himself dropped to the cement. He lay on the cold pavement next to the bench, his left arm above him in the seat, shackled to the armrest. The cops looked behind them and saw four masked men walking down the blacktop road towards their position. They all held rifles similar to the man at the gas station, who was now joined by three Confederates. All eight moved closer with confidence, like they had all the time in the world.
"Uncuff me! We've got to get inside!"
Court yelled, but the policeman just pressed lower into the cement platform, squatted and ducked behind a wooden pushcart or lay flat in the open, and they fired inaccurate rounds at the gunmen as the men in black approached menacingly through the swirling snowfall from opposite directions. A bald-headed young policeman shouted into the radio affixed to the epaulets of his jacket. He crouched 15 feet from Gentry behind a luggage cart that provided him poor shielding from the men on the hill to the north and no cover whatsoever from the men fanned out at the gas station to his south. Court watched bursts of concrete stitch up the platform, race towards the young cop as he looked the other way and screamed into his microphone unaware. Each explosion of cement and dust tracked closer to him until finally, supersonic machine pistol rounds burrowed into his legs and back. He spun onto his side and twitched on the concrete. The death throes ceased as quickly as they began.
"Somebody give me a gun!"
Gentry shouted. The three remaining policemen ignored him. They fired inaccurately and reloaded slowly with jittering hands. Court swiveled around on the cold concrete. He put his boots against the iron legs of the bench and kicked as hard as he could. He desperately tried to break the large iron end piece to which he was manacled, free from the rest of the 12-foot wooden bench. The metal handcuff bit into his left wrist as he kicked and pulled. Soon, he created a rhythm to his work. A kick with his feet, cracks of the old wood, and searing pain in his wrist and hand. A salvo of automatic fire hit the window above him, sending broken glass over the bench and onto the ground all around. As he kicked, he looked back over to his right. A second policeman had been hit in the shoulder and hip. He dropped his gun and writhed on the cement in agony. It took over 30 simultaneous strikes with both feet to break the iron endpiece away from the wooden bench. On the last drive down with his boot heels, he yanked back with his arm. The pain in his left wrist was excruciating, but the bench broke apart. Gentry crawled to his knees, knelt over the heavy piece of ornamental metal, and lifted it. It was easily 30 pounds and still attached to his scraped and swelling wrist. He hooked his handcuffed arm over the metalwork and hefted it off the platform. Then, in the line of fire from both directions, he ran towards the injured cop writhing in agony in the middle of the platform. When he was still a dozen feet away, he flung the iron out in front of him, down next to the man, and fell with it in a slide. The piece clanged on the cement with nearly as much noise as the gunshots barking all around. His swelling wrist tightened inside the metal cuff. Kneeling over the Swiss officer, he reached to the man's midsection. The cop cried out to his rescuer,
"My hip! I'm hit bad in the..."
"Sorry," Court said as he pulled the handcuff key off the chain on the cop's utility belt. It was smeared with the young man's blood. Crouching lower in response to a supersonic whine just inches from his right ear, the American assassin pushed the ornamental iron armrest out in front of him, towards the platform's edge. He crawled along as he pushed it again. The injured policeman reached up and grabbed Court's leg as the American moved away, a pitiable attempt to both seek help from a rescuer and to regain control of his prisoner, as if that were somehow still an issue. Gentry kicked off the dying man's hand, picked the cop's Beretta off the platform, and kept crawling. A spray of subgun rounds chased Court all the way to the edge of the platform, just missing him as he and his iron anchor rolled off. Gentry dropped 4 feet down to the ground and behind the cover of the platform's edge. His adrenaline-tinged brain nearly panicked when he lost the key for a moment in the snow, but he quickly dug it out. Rising to his knees, he kept his frozen red fingers steady as he unhooked the handcuff on his left wrist. Of the 5 policemen who pulled him off the train, only 2 were still in the fight. Both crouched behind poor cover on the platform. Not wanting to place his head in the gun sights of anyone who'd watched him drop off the platform, Court moved down a few feet before he peered back over the top. He shouted to the cops, told them to break cover and come to him. One yelled back that he was out of ammunition. The other had a wounded right hand and was firing over a stone planter with his left. From the look of his technique, Gentry determined the man to be right-hand dominant. Movement in the train station caught Gentry's eye. The few civilians at the station had long since hit the road or hit the deck, so when he saw two men running towards the platform inside the building, Court knew some of the attackers had managed to flank his position. The door to the platform flew open, and two black-masked men appeared over the policeman with the injured hand. Court raised the Beretta in his right hand. His left was useless with its new injury. At 12 yards distance, Gentry shot both masked men in the face. Their forward momentum, coupled with the bullet's impact, caused them to stumble into each other and fall out the door together to the cold platform. Court's borrowed Beretta 92 locked up with the second shot, empty.
"Hey, slide me that rifle!"
This was the third time he'd called for a weapon. The difference this time, of course, was that the first two times were before the two surviving policemen had seen him at work. The young cop with the bloody hand quickly skidded one of the gunman's small black rifles across the platform to Gentry. Court grabbed it and ducked back down. It was an HK MP5, the most ubiquitous submachine gun in the world. It felt comfortable in the gray man's hands. The American pulled the mag and found it full, with 30 rounds of 9mm ball ammo. He shouted to the injured cop to slide the other rifle to the uninjured man. When the transfer was made, Court said,
"Put it on semi-auto! Fire one round at a time in each direction! Do that until it's empty! Do you understand?"
"Oui!"
shouted the cop.
"Go!"
In a crouch, Court hurried along the platform's edge, moving north, closing the distance between himself and the four who'd come from the truck on the hill. A train was approaching in the distance from the north. Court heard sirens from the direction of the village. He tried to push everything from his mind as he crawled forward alongside the track through the snow. Everything but the men, he knew, would now be closing on the platform, just around the corner of the cement ahead. His wrist throbbed, and his knees stung from the window glass lacerations he received escaping from Laszlo Sabot in Budapest the afternoon before. The ever-present pain in his thigh from Thursday's gunshot wound was the least of his maladies at the moment. 10 feet from the corner of the cement platform, he heard them. Men speaking Spanish. Spanish? Was the entire fucking planet trying to kill him? They were tucked down by the steps up to the platform. Though Gentry's ears rang, he was able to make out the clicking and spring-tightening sounds made by the magazine change of an MP5. When he stood, he encountered two masked men, also just standing up. Court fired the HK one-handed, fully automatic, at a distance of less than 10 feet. Both attackers dropped, and Court fired another short burst into each twitching body. He dropped the submachine gun from his hands and hefted a new one off a dead gunman, then spun around and ran back up onto the platform. He never even considered making a run for it, though he had the perfect opportunity to escape both the Spanish-speaking kill squad and the Swiss police. But there was a fight going on. Court was already in it, and disengaging at this point did not seem right. A couple of innocent cops were still alive, and they would not last long on their own. As the sirens approached, flashing lights beat off the few remaining panes of glass in the train station. Court Gentry ran back to the aid of the two policemen, his one good arm holding the HK out in front of him, searching for fresh targets.
Chapter 21.
Claire Fitzroy sat on her bed and looked out the window at the lawn and the thick forest beyond. The sky had been drab and gray since they'd arrived at the chateau the previous afternoon, but during the morning, the low cloud cover had scattered, and now she could see a great distance. Her lunch was beside her, all but untouched. Her sister was downstairs in the kitchen with Mummy and Daddy, and the men in the leather coats who followed around wherever her father went. But Claire had been excused from the table. She told her parents about her tummy ache, asked permission to go back to her room. The tummy ache was real. It came from the worry that had sat heavily inside her for over a day now. The hurried shuffle out of school, the worried faces of Mummy and Daddy, the argument on the phone between her father and grandfather, the arrival of the men with guns, and the trip in the big black cars to the chateau in the countryside. Something outside caught her attention. She leaned closer to the bedroom window, squinted. Then she stood excitedly,
In the distance, she could see the steeples. She knew those steeples. The steeples were from the huge Notre Dame Cathedral in Bayeux, and she knew Bayeux had a police station. It was near the big water wheel her daddy had taken her and her sister to. She remembered the policemen in their smart uniforms smiling at her the previous summer. If she could just get out of the house, maybe she could run across the huge back lawn, through the apple orchard, make her way through the woods and to Bayeux in the cold distance. Once there, she could find the police station and tell them what was happening. They could come help, make the men with the leather coats and the ugly foreign language let her family go. Mummy and Daddy would be so happy. It was a long way away, but she knew she could make it. She was the fastest winger on her football team. She could slip down to the cellar and out the little open window she and her sister chased the cat through the previous evening. Resolute, 8-year-old Claire Fitzroy buttoned up her coat, pulled on her mittens, and cracked open the door to the bedroom. As soon as she stepped into the long and dimly lit hallway, she heard voices at the stairwell, but they came from upstairs. She scurried down the corridor and onto the staircase. Lowering her weight on each step, her little feet moved delicately to avoid making noise. She heard a sudden cry above her. She stopped dead in her tracks and looked up. There was another shout. It came from the third floor. She started to descend again, but looked back up to the source of the noise and heard a low, guttural sound. It was Grandpa Donald. He sounded as if he were sobbing. Quickly now, she made her way to the first floor, bypassing the kitchen and the dining hall carefully, because her parents and sister were having lunch just now. If they saw her, her father would be angry, and he would just tell her to return to her room. The hall turned ahead to the right on the way to the stone steps that led down to the wine cellar. Claire moved quickly, but took care to avoid any noise that would give her away. She turned the corner at a run and nearly crashed into the rear of a huge guard. Claire stopped cold. The man wore a brown turtleneck, and from behind, she could see the black strap of the rifle that hung in front of him on his chest. A handgun and a radio were attached to his belt. He patrolled down the hall, away from her, perfectly silent in his movements. Little Claire did not dare back up or turn and run away. She just stood there, silently, in the middle of the hallway behind him. He walked slowly. 5 feet away at first, then 10, then 20. The guard opened a door to his left. Claire knew from her explorations with her sister the evening before that it was a small bathroom. He pulled the door shut behind him. Behind her, she heard more men talking to one another. Quickly, she hurried past the bathroom door and to the stone steps of the cellar. 1 minute later, she climbed up onto the shelf, pushed her little body through the window, and squeezed out onto the back lawn. She rose to a crouch, looked to her left and right, and saw a man walking a big dog on a leash in the distance. Just like the man in the hallway, he was moving in the opposite direction. Claire looked out past the white stone fountain, past the apple trees to the horizon line. There they were, the steeples of Bayeux Cathedral. One more look around satisfied her, and then she was off. She rose and sprinted as fast as her little legs would take her. It was cold, and her breath steamed as she tore past the fountain, reached the other side, and then ran as she had never run in her life. Just weeks ago, she scored a goal in a match against Walnut Tree Walk Primary School. She was on the left flank when the ball popped free from a bad clearance. She scooped it back towards the goal mouth at a dead run, dribbled close, and fired low, her first goal of the season. Daddy had been so happy he'd taken the girls out for pizza on the way home. He'd spoken of it every day since. Claire ran across the green grass of the manicured lawn like she was running for the ball in front of the goal. She just had to ignore the burning cold air in her chest and the little daggers of pain in her legs. She just had to make it into the orchard where the bad men would not catch her. She just had to get to the steeple so she could find the police station. She just had to tell someone what was going on at the chateau. She just had to rescue her family. She was only a few yards from the start of the orchard, could already smell the sweet apples, when the ear-splitting crack of a rifle snapped across the huge lawn from behind her. echoed off the tree line in front of her, and she stumbled and fell head over heels into the low shrubbery at the orchard's edge.
"What the fuck was that?"
shouted Lloyd in surprise. But he knew a rifle shot when he heard one. He poked his head out of the command center. The guard at the end of the hall on the third floor was clearly as clueless as the questioner. Lloyd rushed past him down the stairs. The young American's suit coat was off, his tie was untied and draped around his neck, and his collar hung wide open. His sleeves had been rolled up, and his armpits, face, and hair were covered in sweat. A mixture of perspiration and blood had streaked across his shirt where he'd recently brushed across a fresh wound. At the second floor landing, he nearly crashed into a Belarusian coming up to get him.
"What's happening? Who's shooting?"
Lloyd asked.
"Come, please do hurry."
Lloyd followed the man down to the first floor. There was screaming in the living area. It was Elise Fitzroy's voice, coming from the kitchen. Men from Minsk yelled back at her. Mr. Felix appeared, asked Lloyd what had happened, and was curtly instructed to return to the library and shut the door. Lloyd started to enter the kitchen, but the guard who'd been leading the way turned back and took him by the arm. He said something, but his English was poor. Lloyd brushed the man's hand off him, but followed him out the back door. At first, the American lawyer saw nothing but the white stone fountain, the green lawn, the distant apple orchard, and the clear blue sky. He followed the guard, moved sideways around the fountain, and found three Belarusians and a dog standing over a form on the grass.
Gentry?
Lloyd could not believe it. How had he made it so quickly to? The man with the dog stepped aside, giving Lloyd a clean view of the body face down on the lawn. Lloyd's jaw tensed.
Shit! Shit! This is the last thing I needed today!
Just then, another security man appeared from the orchard, another 150 yards away. He held the leash of a large black hunting dog in his right hand. Across his chest was a shotgun, and the firm grip of his left hand was cinched around the wrist of a little girl with brown hair. One of the twins. Lloyd hadn't taken the time to learn their names, much less tell them apart. Lloyd yanked the radio off the hip of the Belarusian who had led him out to the yard. He pressed the transmit button.
"You, take her around to the front entrance. We don't need a hysterical brat on our hands."
"Yes, sir,"
said the man in the distance through his walkie-talkie. He yanked hard on the girl, pulled her along the edge of the orchard, well out of view of the body of her father that lay face down in the thick grass. A small hole drilled in the back of his head, and his face blown off. Gentry pulled out onto the highway, heading south to Lausanne, and then passed to round Lake Geneva to the west. His green panel truck had a few 9mm holes in it, but the oil pressure and gas needles remained steady in the center of each gauge. Behind him at the train station, at least 4 South Americans lay dead in the snow. The rest were pinned down by the 8 men from the 4 police cruisers that had just arrived on the scene. Court had made it across the tracks just as the large intercity train passed. He'd then doubled back up the hill and climbed into the green truck with the keys in it and the engine running. And now he was hauling ass. 15 minutes earlier, he'd been the most wanted man in Switzerland, though that mantle had surely been handed off to the Latin gunners shooting it out back at the train station. Court knew he was still in second place, and the local authorities would soon enough put the word out that a highly wanted man was driving around in a bullet-pocked green panel truck. Chapter 22. No one told the Belarusians at Chateau Laurent about the helicopter. Consequently, pandemonium ensued when a Sikorsky S-76 appeared over the woods to the south, banked hard, and landed at the helipad next to the gravel car park. Lloyd alone had been informed of the impending arrival of the helicopter from Paris. He sat in the control room, listened to the rotor wash beat against the leaded glass window next to him. He'd sent the tech downstairs for a lunch break, and he'd pushed Fitzroy's chair, with Sir Donald chained to it, into an adjoining bathroom. Lloyd just sat there alone and stared at the stone wall in front of him. 3 minutes later, the door behind him opened. Lloyd did not turn around immediately.
"Lloyd! Lloyd!"
Slowly, the American attorney rotated his swivel chair to face the newest guest to the chateau.
Regal was a big man, 6'5" at least. He had swept back blonde hair with flecks of gray and bushy blonde eyebrows. He wore thick khaki pants and a casual suede sport coat. His shirt was open at the collar. He was 20 years or so older than Lloyd, but he'd not let his body soften, and already his powerful voice and overbearing countenance told Lloyd the afternoon would be difficult and terrible.